are, that I am. I am pure effect or meaning,
or truth, or the good.
I reach out for them. I make incremental advances in satisfying that demand as I raise and answer particular questions.
It's slightly like the energy between the question and the manner.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Tom?
Is the spirit different from
intentionality? No. Yeah. Right. I use intentionality for those who may have problems with the metaphysics and the spirit. Intentionality, at least I can say, in experience, this is what I mean by it. You know? But for me, the root of that is an ontological root that is pure spirit. Tom asked the question last week, how about these less extreme deviations in the direction of limitation? Because I mentioned that Becker says most of us are somewhere over here most of the time. We're not depressed, or we're certainly not chronically or acutely but we're in this direction in the sense that most people do not and will not recognize the extent of their possibilities. Shut themselves off from the fullness of the possibilities that are really theirs. They buy into a culturally determined fabric of meanings and values. And they establish their self-esteem by performing up to the expectations of the culture. And they let the culture determine meanings and values that are theirs. And the most pedestrian examples of that are, you know, what kind of house do you have, and how bright are your children, and how many cars, and how many TV sets, and so on and so forth. But it gets into much more sophisticated and subtle sorts of things. You know, in religious communities, how many responsibilities does the superior give you? Or in academic life, how fast are you making it up the ladder towards honorary doctorates, you know, that sort of thing. That's that kind of, you know, that if you want, when you start letting that sort of thing determine your self-esteem, then you are letting a cultural set of mores determine the meanings and values by which you live, and that limits the possibilities that are truly yours. So most people live in a mild displacement, says Becker, in the direction of limitation. They're defeatists. He says, and he's himself very pessimistic, you know, if you've read his book, that we emerge out of childhood already defeated. Childhood, the first 5 years are so difficult, and what we have had to contend with, that we've already surrendered. And we have bought into the fabric that is determined by the culture. That's when I was, when the Vietnam War was going on, and my nephew was about six, my brother is a little bit to the right of Genghis Khan. I'm not, and, at least politically. And I was talking with my nephew about the Vietnam War, and he was six, and he said, well, the only thing to do is go in there and bomb the hell out of them. He had bought into the cultural fabric that had been handed on to him, and obviously you don't try to argue rationally with but it was an instance of, you know, that there's an assumption that's taken over that's unquestioned for the present time. Now, perhaps 10 years older now, he may be questioning it. Or another way of getting at the same thing, Abraham Maslow says that less than 1% of the adult population is what he calls self-realizing. That is to say, really in that creative tension. That's not a very optimistic statistic. And the other point is that I mentioned last time, we can oscillate from one extreme to the other, and you have some psychotic instances of manic depressive conditions where the person is oscillating from the schizophrenic state to the depressive state and back and forth. But at the less extreme, you can get that oscillation too in an unhealthy way. There is a healthy oscillation of differentiation, integration, But the unhealthy oscillation there would be the person who is always, first of all, overshooting the mark, failing, giving up completely, see, until the next opportunity comes along and then overshooting the mark once again.
I'm probably jumping ahead, but at some point, the example of Christ in the Gospel, I mean, if you follow a Tad Dunn sort of course, you can see the Trinitarian theology coming out, creative vectors and healing vectors. I just wonder, is that a way you're going? I mean, at all?
I'm sure it's not contrary to the way I'm going, but I'm not really moving into the direction of systematics. I want to continue developing a psychology rather than a theology.
For instance, I can think of Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane with the cup. There's the taut balance there. And all those.
Yeah. See, with him, of course, the taut balance is different. It is, if you accept the tradition. That's the taut balance of humanity and divinity in the consciousness. It's the extreme tension. Created and uncreated being, one conscious subjectivity. But it's the same, if you can work with the vectors. But that's why the power of the word that he speaks and of the things that he does, you see, as Jung says, the more extreme the tensions are in which psychic energy is the mediating factor, the greater the power. And so that's why the psychic energy of the human being is able to release those symbols that have such power, because our psychic energy is between the opposites of matter and spirit. Now, you take that and you make a quantum leap, I think, when you talk about the power of Jesus, you see, as a power that emerges from the interaction of humanity.
So you can never, in your models, you would never use Jesus' life as a model for our own. I mean,
Not in this way, anyway. I mean, I would start with this and then say, all right, now by analogy, we might move to a psychology of Jesus, you see, using this as the basis. I might move in that direction. But, you know, if the tradition does say this, that we're dealing with a unique instance in that case. Unique instance that extends through the whole thing, including conscious experience. It's unique there. And any analogy is going to be only a partial opening upon the mystery. But this might be a helpful analogy for making the quantum leap to the understanding of Jesus. An analogy, you know, John Courtney Murray once said, you know, most people say that analogy means it's partly the same and partly different. Analogy means it's partly the same and totally different. you know, so you can take this and then say, all right, now we're making a quantum leap when we use this model to talk about Jesus.
When you spoke, I think it was last Sunday, you gave examples of the two extremes, the wife of a friend who took depression and the other friend, and the other friend who was so absorbed in the speculation that the dreams of the body had been. What practically does that mean in the sense of this type of disorder? What is the usual therapeutic advice? What does the person have to do with that? What option to do in general? And the other way. Should she interest herself more in the level of spirit than your second friend in helping child work?
To the extent that that's possible, yes. I would definitely recommend the speculative friend get out and chop wood or plant flowers or something. You know. The other side of it, I'm not so sure. You know. You have to, I think if you're working with a person like that therapeutically, as a therapist, you have to pick up on whatever glimmer there is of a self-transcendent interest. If there is an artistic sensitivity, it's not dead yet. You've got to start with that. You know? If she likes antiques, you know, then you've got to start with that. I think. Just encourage the development so that there's some kind of humanity that could emerge out of dealing with antiques. Or
another way of explaining that might be that she did two parts of herself and herself and
herself. Yeah.
Have to be grown out of cancer, have to be pursued.
That's right. Okay, we're... Well, that wasn't just a repetition, I don't think. Well, that was enough. New material came up. But now we are moving into number 7 on the anagogic context of all psychological experiences. The first of all, there, A, the context. The point that I want to make, and I'm speaking here as both a believer and a theologian and a philosopher. The intentionality that the psyche participates in or the creative vector, if you want, same notion, is, in the last analysis, a pure question for God. Question whose only total adequate answer is the vision of God, participation in the life of the triune God in a final way. That our desire for meaning, for truth, for the good, in the last analysis I will hold, is a desire for the fullness of being in knowledge and love, to be, to know and to love fully and irrevocably and irretrievably the God who has made and who has made everything, who is the origin of everything and the destiny of everything. In terms of the tradition, Aquinas speaks of our human spirit as a natural desire for the vision of God. Desire that is in nature. It's natural. It's not a supernatural desire. Its fulfillment is supernatural. The desire itself is natural. Or Augustine, you know, the restlessness that will not be satisfied until it rests in God. Famous thing. Statement from the Confessions. You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. In terms of what Vogelin says, the direction of history is, or the goal of history is eschatological. Or in Lonergan's terminology, we are a pure question that God answers in the gift of his love. In two ways. Through the inner word that he speaks in our hearts, and through the outer word of the incarnate Logos. So, what I'm simply trying to say here is this, that if our psyches participate in that drive, ultimately, and in the last analysis, a drive for the divine, then that is the ultimate and final context for psychological experience. And for understanding human affective experience. That doesn't mean that every affective experience is related immediately to that. I'm not saying that at all. An immediate affective experience can be related to an immediate datum. I can have an immediate affective experience of any one of you. But what I'm saying is that the ultimate context for affectivity is the thrust towards the life, the divine life. And therefore, it is an anagogic context. As I've used the term anagogic in talking about anagogic symbolism. Our affective experience, to put it, what does anagogic mean? Pointing beyond. Our affective experience is pointing beyond everything that is within the limited horizon of created being. It will not be satisfied. Our affectivity will not be satisfied by anything within created being or by the whole of created being. It will be satisfied incrementally, yes, as I raise and answer a given question for intelligibility, for truth, for the good. But I'll find that another question emerges. On and on and on in the questioning process. And the relentlessness of my quest is the symbol for the totality of the goal. The goal is the totality of the life of God, to share in that. And so my mind will not be satisfied short of vision of God, and my heart will not be satisfied short of the love of God in a final and irrelevant fashion. Vogelin's way of expressing this, he has some nice ways of putting things, I think, is that the psyche is the sensorium of transcendence. It is the place where the transcendence of the human spirit is sensed, is felt, the sensorium of transcendence. Our mind may be the operator of transcendence, but our psyche is the sensorium. It is the place in our being where we sense, where we feel our orientation to the transcendent God. Ultimately, pneumopathology is the loss of that orientation. And psychopathology, in the last analysis, is the psychic breakdown that comes when that orientation is lost, when transcendence is no longer sensed, felt as the movement of human life. Things become flattened out in the way that we feel. They become flattened out into a purely mundane existence. Yes.
What did you just call that experience?
Pneumopathology. You know, I've been using that expression. Pneumopathology is the loss of that orientation to transcendence, and psychopathology results in this, in the sensorium, in the psyche. You see, when that orientation is no longer sensed and felt and lived, and when it no longer provides energy for the psyche, the spark of life. Oh, it's all over. I mean, it is in the air we breathe, the loss of that. Just, I'll mention this as an example, and then I'll start on the next thing after the break. I mentioned in class a couple of weeks ago the scale of values and how religious values condition the possibility of sustained authenticity, or what modern would call personal values. But religious values are necessary. The religious life, the life of grace, is necessary for sustained integrity in the human person. And that sustained integrity is necessary if you're going to have continual supply of cultural values, that is to say, of genuine literature, art, philosophy, music, so on and so forth, the values that establish culture, and how that enrichment of the human psyche and spirit that comes about through cultural values is necessary if people are going to be able to set up a just social order, because only when those cultural values are present are the questions going to be alive in the culture that would lead to justice in the social order, and how the just social order is necessary if you're going to have the distribution of vital goods. So without the just social order, you get the maldistribution of vital goods. The first and second world today have amputated the scale of value. The top three are not publicly acknowledged as being the ground of the institutions that are set up in the social order by which the distribution of vital values is assured. So, and this is true in the capitalist and the Soviet bureaucracies, but it's true in the case. Just the amputation of the scale of value. And this is the pneumopathology of our time. So, and that scale of values is amputated so that everything is collapsed into institutional order and vital values, you see. And the election in the United States last week or 2 weeks ago, or whenever it was, I keep trying to put it back as far as I can. everybody was dealing with it right here. You see? Which one of these two people is going to set up a social order that deals with this in the way that I want? You see? And it wasn't even and for many people, was the question even of the good social order was not the question. What's more to my advantage? Expedience. But these things, you see, or false religious values, the moral majority, you see, false religious values.
What is next to John?
Personal values and cultural values. Personal values, integrity, authenticity. Cultural values would be the art, the literature, the philosophy, the journalism, the media, and everything that would flow out of authentic human beings. Or another, how often is intelligent discussion part of your experience? Our culture. Intelligent discussion without passionate, self-centered interest involved. It's rare. It's rare. Even in universities, maybe especially. That's great.